Morning. Fair warning to our Smart Road members. We're going to be taking a break from our regularly scheduled programming. We've been going through the book of Hebrews the last few weeks. But I've been asked this morning to spend some time on a different subject, a topic that's in relation to some of what was discussed yesterday. One of Tad's sessions yesterday was on sin. And I wasn't here, but as I understand it, he spent most of his time talking about some of the consequences of sin, and specifically in dealing with temptation. I imagine that some of what I'll talk about this morning will overlap with some of what he had to say, but I was asked to spend a little bit of time this morning looking at and considering how God views sin, specifically how he hates sin and how it is ugly to him. And while I imagine many of the same points will be brought out as from yesterday, and maybe even some of the same scriptures referenced, I hope that we'll have some time or I hope we'll spend our time drilling down on a few points that Tad didn't necessarily address. So why would this be something we'd want to talk about? Well, I think it's important to understand as best we can, anyways, God's perspective on sin, because it helps us to understand how important it is to have it out of our lives. We as people, just as humans, we have a tendency to trivialize and not want to take responsibility for our sins. Thinking back to Genesis chapter 3 with Adam and Eve in the garden, how did Adam respond? And I am asking this question, how did Adam respond when God confronted him about his sin, about eating the fruit? What did he say? He blamed it on Eve. Yeah, the woman that you gave me the fruit from the tree. Well, then when God turned to Eve, what did she say?
Serpent.
That's right. So the very first instance of sin, we have people looking at each other, blaming other people for their actions. And if you've raised children, I mean, you get this on full display all the time. It's almost innate. Any conflict is someone else's fault, someone else's wrongdoing. Now, as adults, we'd like to think that we've matured and we've grown out of this, but I think a close, honest examination of ourselves may prove otherwise. Also, an examination of the world around us provides us with more than ample evidence that people are not willing to take responsibility for their own actions and their own wrongdoings. I mean, we have a whole society of people that spend their time blaming others for their decisions, blaming others for their problems, blaming society for their issues. We also have a tendency to trivialize sin, and I'll talk about this a little more later, but we can grow callous to the sin around us, which can lead us to exposing ourselves to sinful behavior that we don't need to see, that we don't need to be part of, and that's damaging to us, that will tempt us to commit sin ourselves. We can also write off our own sinful behavior. You know, this isn't something that bad, or maybe it's something I only occasionally slip about. So we trivialize it, we put it aside, we don't address it, we don't take it seriously. And if we're not willing to take responsibility for our sins, then we'll continue in them. And if we trivialize sins, we will continue them in our lives and continue to expose ourselves to things that will tempt us to sin. And all of this just results in more of this thing in our life that God hates, that God sees as an abomination, as we'll talk about later. But if we can remember and carry around with us this idea, not this idea, but this fact, that this thing that we're doing or this thing that we're exposing ourselves to is indeed something that God sees as ugly, that he sees like a festered wound on flesh. We'll go to Isaiah chapter 1. He talks about that there. I think that carrying that perspective with us can help us to be more vigilant about avoiding sin, avoiding temptation, and find it in our own lives. And I think also considering for a few minutes why God sees sin in this way can be helpful to us as well. You know, a lot of people look at God's definition of sin and they view it as some being has arbitrarily made up some rules that they have to follow. And that puts that perspective puts a bad taste in a lot of people's mouths. And that perspective can cause people to be resentful towards God. And I think we see that all the time. There's so many people out there who hate the concept of God because they view him as someone who has set up some arbitrary rules that prohibit them from living from doing what they want to do and living life the way they want to live it. But that's not what sin is. Sin is not some arbitrary set of rules. It's not some list of things that God just came up with on things that you can do and things that you can't do. I think one of the things that Tad talked about yesterday is that God finds sin offensive because it is against his nature. He is the opposite of sin. He is lightness and sin is darkness. Now, I'm not going to rebuild that point today, but it brings up the fact that this isn't a random set of rules. It's not God going through and saying, I'm going to make this thing offensive and this thing not offensive. No, the things that are sin are against his nature. They are naturally abhorrent to them. And what we see, and this is important, what we see that sin does is that it is destructive to his creation and his relationship with his creation. And let's consider that for a moment, just a few different points on that. And we'll just talk about here real briefly how sin has brought ruin to his creation, how it separates his creation, namely us, from him, and how it represents his creation choosing something other than him. So let's start off here, thinking back to Genesis chapter 1 here for a moment. And let's go back to God in those days of creation. On the first day, we see that he separates light from dark. On the second day, he creates the firmament. I always have a hard time saying that word, firmament. Firmament, okay. And divides the waters. Then on days 3 through 6, he goes about the rest of the creation. As he completes each part of the creation, what do we see him do there? As he completes each part, as he goes through each day and he completes each part, what does he do? He calls it good, right? He reflects on his work. He looks at what he's done, and he says it's good. After he gathered the heavens and he gathers dry land, separating it from water, he sees that his work is good. After he created the plants, the grass, the herbs, the fruit, he looks upon his work, and he sees that it is good. And he continues to do this as he creates the stars and the sun and the moons, and when he creates the animals and mankind as well. And then once all of creation is done, once he's made it through the whole thing, at the conclusion of the sixth day, he looks over his work, and what does he say there? Very good. That's right. He says it's very good. And that's not a distinction that was added by our translators. The word very there is a Hebrew word that's not included in the other times that God reflected on his work. And it means exactly what it implies, right? When God looked at the work as a whole, his level of satisfaction, I guess you can say, was greater than when he reflected on each part of creation. And it's interesting to think about God reflecting upon his work. You know, it's something that we do, but to think of God, who is so powerful to create, not build, but to create such a magnificent thing, and here he is reflecting on the work, admiring what he made, and being satisfied with what he created just as he created it. And in the midst of all that, he places man in the garden, a being to tend to the creation, a being for him to convene with, to walk in the garden with, and it was perfect, and it was everlasting. And then came sin. And then came sin. Romans chapter 5, verse 12, Paul writes that through one man sin entered the world, and death through sin. That's what we see in Genesis chapter 3 in verses 16 through 19 as God announces to Adam and Eve what the consequences for their sin would be. Children would now be brought into the world through pain. Toil would be required to produce food needed for life. Life would be finite. Their bodies would return to dust from which they came. And also, as a consequence for their sin, they were thrown out of the garden. And there we find that very basic point, that very fundamental point that sin separates man from God. And not only were Adam and Eve changed that day, but so was the earth. We find in those verses that the ground was cursed. It would now bring forth thorns and thistles. And it's an interesting thing to think about, to try to imagine for a moment how the world changed after sin. Because I don't know that we can fully conceptualize this. Talks about here that the ground would now bring forth thorns and thistles, but also there would be more toil required to grow the things for food, for sustenance. Seems that the ground would be less yielding, less willing to provide food. And all of this because of sin. So we find there that sin didn't just affect Adam and Eve and mankind, it seems to have affected all of creation. Romans chapter 8, verses 18 through 22 supports this idea because Paul there writes about the groaning of all of creation under the weight of sin. And he says in verse 20, he talks about there that the creation was subjected to futility. In verse 21, he writes of the creation being in the bondage of corruption. Now, I don't fully understand this. I don't fully understand how sin impacted all of creation. And I think it's hard for us to conceptualize what creation might have looked like before sin to make that comparison. But regardless, we see there that there is an impact that sin has on not just mankind, but all of creation. And sin would then only build from there. It would go through people and it would become such an issue that God would one day look at the world and decide to destroy all of mankind. Now, I think this is something that's difficult for us to fully relate to. We've never really truly created anything. We may have built or accomplished some things, but not like God has. But even in our own meager experiences, I think we can find possibly some similarities, some situations where we may be able to see what God feels like in this thing that has ruined his creation. Have you ever done something or created something that you look back upon with some degree of satisfaction? And it doesn't have to be anything big. It doesn't have to be anything major. But all of us have probably built something, worked towards something with some kind of a goal, beautified an area of the yard or the house or even just mowed the lawn. There's some satisfaction in that as well when you see that work. Maybe you studied for exam and you did well. Or you worked hard to develop some kind of a skill, whether it be in sports or some other thing. And you've done this thing, and you've taken some satisfaction in it. Right? And I'm not talking about pride or lifting yourself up, but you have a feeling of accomplishment, like that you have in accomplishing this thing. Now take that thing, whatever it might be, whatever you have in your mind, and imagine that someone or something comes along and destroys it, or takes it away from you, or separates you from that. How would you feel about that thing? And in a way, God in Scripture has used metaphors like this to try to get us to understand his perspective on what sin has done and what this looks like to him. He's not done this with creation, but we've seen him do this a couple times with the children of Israel. I'll just give a couple instances here. The first is over in Isaiah chapter 5. In Isaiah chapter 5, verses 1 through 7, I'll get there eventually. We have God comparing the nation of Israel to a vineyard. We'll read verses 1 and 2 here. Now let me sing to my well-beloved a song of my beloved regarding his vineyard. My well-beloved has a vineyard on a very fruitful hill. He dug it up and cleared out its stones and planted it with the choicest vine. He built a tower in its midst, and he made a wine press in it. So he expected it to bring forth good grapes, but it brought forth wild grapes. So we find here that God in this passage is compared to somebody who prepared this vineyard. And what he's talking about the nation of Israel here. And the comparison he's making is that he picked a good place for it to be, with good ground, a place where it would yield well. The choicest vine was used. He set it up. He did everything that he could to set this thing up for success. He cleared the ground. He built a wine press. And all that work, he does all that work, and what's the result of it? It yields wild grapes. And he's looking at that, and he's saying, Nation of Israel, my people, this is what I've done for you. This is the work that I've put in. And what you've yielded for me is sin. What you've yielded for me is sin. There's another example of this, something similar to this over in Ezekiel chapter 16. I'm not going to read really any verses from that passage right now, but just kind of summarize some of the points there. I once heard an evangelist describe this chapter as the saddest chapter in the Bible, and I have a hard, I'm hard-pressed to find something that is sadder than this chapter. In that chapter, we find that God compares the children of Israel to a newborn child, a newborn girl that he found cast away in a field. It was a baby that had been cast away in a field by itself, unclean from birth. Its navel cord still attached to its body. It's struggling in its own blood. This child was left there to die. It was abandoned. No one wanted it. And yet we see God takes the child in. He makes her thrive. He clothes her. He washed her. He clothes her with the finest clothes, adorns her with jewels and gold and silver, covers her in silk, fed her with pastry of fine flour, honey, and oil. Right? And all those descriptions are found there in Ezekiel chapter 16. And she was beautiful. She was beautiful. And this is what God is talking about, what he did for the nation of Israel, what he's done for his people. But when she matured, she gave herself to other gods. She gave herself to other gods. So we have these metaphors here in Scripture where God is showing us how he's invested into these things, invested into his people. And they have come to ruin. And in the case, in each of these cases, the ruining factor is sin. Sin takes the things that he has created and it brings them to ruin. It changes them. It takes them from their purpose. It produces evil instead of good. And this is something that God grieves over. Something that he grieves over. In Genesis chapter 6, as God is looking at the wickedness of the world, and this is just before the flood here, he's looking at the wickedness of the world, and we find him taking account of what's going on there. In verses 5 and 6 of Genesis 6, it reads, "Then the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only on evil continually. And the Lord was sorry that he had made man on earth, and he was grieved in his heart." He was grieved in his heart. Passages like this always fascinate me because of that description there, which says that God grieved in his heart. And I don't know, but I don't think God has a heart in the same sense that we do. But the language is here at least to signify the level of grief that he felt over seeing the sin, the widespread sin of mankind. He felt it fully and deeply. It was a sense of remorse and even regret at having made a being that would turn so evil. We also see that he expressed his grief over the result of the sin of the generation of the Israelites who would die in the wilderness. And we find this over in Psalm chapter 95. I guess Dan will touch on this a little bit next week when he's in Hebrews 3 as well. Yeah. So this is I'm going to reference Hebrews 3 twice this morning, Dan. I'm sorry. Not sorry, but sorry, not sorry. Psalm 95, verses 8 through 11 read, "Do not harden your hearts as in the rebellion, as in the day of trial in the wilderness, when your fathers tested me. They tried me, though they saw my work. For 40 years I was grieved with that generation and said, it is a people who go astray in their hearts, and they do not know my way. So I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest." So this generation that he's speaking of is the generation of Jews who had to wander in the wilderness for 40 years because of their sin, right? These are the ones that he had delivered out of Egypt, out of slavery. He had done miracle after miracle. He had brought them through the Red Sea. He had provided them with food and water and everything that they needed. And yet, they turned their heart from him. Because of their complaining and grumbling in the face of God's deliverance of them, they had to wander in the wilderness for 40 years as they just simply died out, not able to enter the promised land. And you get a sense from these verses that God was watching this generation die with grief. Sad to watch these people not get to enter the promised land because they had strayed from him, because they had sinned. And one important thing that we see in this passage is that when we choose sin, we are effectively not choosing God. We are choosing something other than God. In this passage in Psalm 95, God refers to the behavior of the Israelites as a rebellion. It's an opposition to the authority and a place of God. And this specific generation of Israelites provides a good picture of what it looks like to God, because God very directly impacted their lives. He brought them out of slavery. He took them through the waters of the Red Sea. He provided them with all the things that they needed for their nourishment. He's taking them to the promised land. And yet they sinned. And that is what sin is to all of us. And we're all in that same position. It's what it was to Adam and Eve. who were placed in an unimaginably beautiful garden, a garden they were given life through the breath of God. They were communing with God, nothing to fear, nothing to hide from, no sickness, no death. They couldn't even possibly realize how good they had it. And yet, they chose sin. They chose themselves. And it's the same way for us today. We're not in the garden, but our blessings are numerous. The life that we have been given, the things that the Lord has done for us, what he has given for us, what he has sacrificed for us. If we sin, we turn from that. And when you take all this into consideration, I think you get a greater sense of why God sees sin the way that he does. It's brought death and ruin to his creation. The beings that he created for good works turn to evil and wrongdoing. And instead of appreciating what he has given them, they spurn it. They turn from him. It represents his creation choosing something other than him. Here in just a second, we're going to look at a few verses that where God describes him. Before I do that, does anybody have any comments, anything they want to add to this, any questions? Looks like you're safe, Bill. What time? Somebody get the time that I have. What time do I have till? 22 after. Okay, so I got 20 minutes. Perfect. Okay. All right, so God sees sin as filth. It's a stain. It's something that requires washing and removal, or it does not come off. And let's run through a few verses here that talk about sin in this context. Let's turn over to Isaiah chapter 1. In this first chapter of Isaiah, God seems to be contextualizing why there's a need for a prophet. He's talking about the condition of the nation of Israel here. And in the first few verses, he talks about the nation, the people there, in much of the same fashion that we've been talking about sin this morning, that despite what the Lord has done for them, they are rebellious. In verse 4, they're described as a sinful nation, laden with iniquity. Dropping down into verses 5 and 6, this is how God describes the people. Why should you be stricken again? You will revolt more and more. The whole head is sick, and the whole heart faints. From the sole of the foot even to the head, there is no soundness in it, but wounds and bruises and putrefying sores, they have not been closed or bound up or soothed with ointment. And so here we're given a picture that God... This is how God relates to us, what he sees when he looks at the nation of Israel and the sins that they have. A sick body, one covered in festered, untreated sores. Now, I've never seen a body covered in festered sores. I don't think I've ever seen a festered sore, something that's gone. I'm not going to try to use medical terms because I'm just going to do it wrong, and then the medical people, particularly my wife, will smile at me. So we're going to leave that, but I've never seen that, but there are people who have in here who have, and I'm sure it's very unpleasant to look at. You have pus and oozing and grossness, and that's how God tries to communicate what he sees when he looks at sin. It's not a great visual. Later on in the chapter, in verse 18, he compares sin to a red crimson stain. The language there denotes that sin leaves an obvious mark, a blemish, impossible to remove but for the work of God. We also find that many times in scriptures, throughout scriptures, God refers to sin or sinful people as an abomination. And that's a strong word. It's not the word that we use a lot. That's not a word I use a lot. I think the only time I've ever used that word is maybe in a joking sense, because it's such a strong word. It describes something that has been distorted or mutilated into something disgusting and abhorrent. Something that is loathsome and detested. We see an example of this over in Proverbs chapter 16. Excuse me, Proverbs chapter 6, verse 16. Proverbs chapter 6, 6 through 16. And here God lists seven things, and we know that these things are sin. He doesn't identify them here as sin, but we can tell from the context here that they are sin. And he calls them an abomination. These six things the Lord hates, yes, seven, are an abomination to him. A proud look, a lying tongue, hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that devises wicked plans, feet that are swift to running to evil, a false witness who speaks lies, and one who sows discord among brethren. Now, there's even some things listed here that may not even seem like a big deal to us at times, right? A proud look, someone with pride, someone conceited and full of themselves, a lying tongue, one who sows discord among brethren, you know, a person whose behavior and words causes division, lies. But God sees all these things as an abomination, and he hates them. He hates these things. We also find in Deuteronomy chapter 26, or actually 25 and verse 16, after God goes through a list of ordinances in the old law, he says, "For all who do such things, all who behave unrighteously, are an abomination to your God." Another time where he's calling sin an abomination. Proverbs 11 and 20, "Those who are of a perverse heart are an abomination to the Lord, but the blameless in their ways are his delight." So we have that passage talking about people who commit sin and carry sin with them are an abomination to God. There's a lot of other passages that we could look at that use similar language to give us an idea about how strongly God feels against sin. That sin or those who are unrighteous are an abomination. They are abhorrent. We could also spend some time, actually quite a bit of time, looking at the old law and reviewing the many provisions that are there to cleanse the people from sin. And that would further illustrate the point that sin is a stain. It's something that has to be washed away through the sacrifice of the innocent, which is something that God has deemed should happen. That's how bad sin is, that he is willing to sacrifice the innocent. And it's disgusting enough that he's willing to go to those lengths. And under the old law, it was done through the continual sacrifice of animals. But ultimately, it was done through what? Sacrifice of his son. God hates sin so much, and it's so revolting to him that he was willing to give up his son so that it could wash away that from us. That's what he was willing to give to remove this filth. It must be truly disgusting to him, and he must truly love us to be willing to do that. I'll pause again. Does anybody have anything they want to say, anything they want to add? Questions? Okay, so let's spend the last few minutes here considering how all of this should impact our own view of sin. And not just from the point of view that we should have it out of our lives, but just from the perspective of how we see sin, even if we're not the ones that are committing it, even if we're just viewing it in the world. Because I think we need to do our best to try to see sin the same way that God does. Now, I don't think that's fully achievable. Right? I don't think we can look at sin the same way God does because God is holy. And given that he's holy, it's not really a choice for him to see sin as he does. It's just who he is. But that's not the position we're in. We have to make that choice to see sin the way that God does. We have to make many choices to see sin that way. It has to be a decision that we make to do that. And as I brought up towards the beginning of class, we tend to trivialize sin and grow desensitized to it. And there are at least a few scriptures that illustrate this point. Romans chapter 1 certainly came to mind when I was thinking about this. And in that passage in Romans chapter 1, towards the latter half of the chapter, Paul is writing about just kind of the cycle that the Gentiles go through and falling deeper into sin. Talks about this path where at first they know God, but they don't glorify him as God, and then they fall into not being thankful, and the path continues on until God gives them up to their sin. Right? So they become more and more accustomed into sin, they become deeper and deeper into it. Ephesians chapter 4, 17 through 19, I will take a second to read that, because it gives kind of the same connotation here. That passage reads, "This I say, therefore, and testify in the Lord, that you should no longer walk as the rest of the Gentiles walk in the futility of their mind, having their understanding darkened, being alienated from the life of God because of the ignorance that is in them, because of the blindness of their heart, who, being past feeling, have given themselves over to lewdness, to work all uncleanness with greediness." So here we have Paul writing about the Gentiles that had given themselves over to sin so much that there was a futility of their mind, right? Their understanding was darkened. It says in verse 19 that they were past feeling. I think that means their conscience was seared. They didn't look at sin as evil. They didn't look at it as wrongdoing. They had become conditioned to it and used to it. So these passage illustrates how we can get to the point where we're fully desensitized to sin and that there's a path that we can take to get there. But even if we don't go that far, right, even if we don't get to the point where we're talking about here, it is possible for us to become increasingly comfortable with sin and have that cause ourselves and those around us trouble and temptation. And I think a good example of this happening is Lot. I think Lot provides us a good example of someone who kind of casually or over time became more and more comfortable with being around sin. And if we go back to Genesis chapter 13, we find in that passage Abraham and Lot had decided to divide their livestock and go their own separate ways. And there Abraham gives Lot a choice as to which area he would take, which area he would take his livestock to. And in verses 10 through 13 of that passage, it tells us that Lot chose the plain of Jordan to take his livestock to. What was in the plain of Jordan? What was there? What city was there? What? It was good pasture. What else was there? Sodom. Sodom was there. Yeah, it was great pasture. It says that before the destruction of Sodom, that it was full of water. I don't remember the exact terminology, but full of water or something like that. I guess I could look at the Bible. It's right here in front of me. Verse 10. Yeah, well-watered everywhere. That's what it says. It was well-watered everywhere. But also what was there was Sodom. And we can tell from those verses a few different things. Number one, like we just mentioned, it was a good place for them for animals to be, and that the plain was a good size. There's plenty of room. There's plenty of room there, plenty of room away from the city of Sodom. But the city of Sodom was there, and the scriptures notes in that passage there that it was a wicked place, that it was full of wicked people. Now, as we go through this chapter, and all the way up to chapter 19, we find Lot goes from taking his livestock to this plain, right? So he's decided, hey, this is where I'm going to take my livestock. I'll take this land. Abraham, you take this. He takes his livestock. The next thing we know in this passage in chapter 19 or chapter 13 here, he's pitching his tent near the city. And then in chapter 14, we find that he's living in the city. And then in chapter 19, we find him sitting at the gates of the city. Right, so progressively we find him, he's choosing the plain, he's pitching his tent near the city, he's living in the city, and then he's sitting at the gates of the city, which implies at this point that he had really fully invested himself into that place. Now, we're not given much information into Lot's thinking in all this, but I don't think it's a stretch to say that he became increasingly comfortable with what was going on there in the city of Sodom. And that he found that there was enough earthly benefit there for him to ignore the sin that he found in that city. The first thing that took him there was seeing how lush the plain was, right? I'll go this way because the plain was lush. And the scripture said it's well-watered everywhere, but there's this sore of wickedness here. But that's all right. It's all right. We can still be there. It's not that bad. And then slowly, he integrates more and more into that city. And that same progression can take ourselves, us, closer to sin as well. We overlook the bad things in things that we expose ourselves to. Maybe in the shows that we watch, the music we listen to the social media personalities we follow, the people that we spend time with. We see the sin there, but we become accustomed to it. We allow ourselves to overlook it. We don't want to miss on what else is there. And that's something that we have to be very careful about. Because there's no way that we can completely avoid exposure to sin in this world, right? We can't do that, nor do I think we're expected to. But like Lot, we do have some level of choice, don't we? Lot never had to, even though he was in that plane, he never had to live in that city, did he? But he made that choice to do that. And we too have a lot of control over what we see and where we go and what we spend our time doing and who we spend our time with. And if we're not careful, if we start ignoring the sin in those places, if we stop seeing sin the same way God does, when we do that, we open ourselves up to the same sins. Another good lesson that we can take from Lot, and specifically the city of Sodom here, is that I think that it becomes also easy to marginalize certain sins. And we have to be careful about that. And I think the scriptures show us that there are sins that are more egregious than others. That's true. For example, under the old law, certain sins carried harsher punishment than others. You know, no one's going to convincingly argue that a young child lying about taking a piece of candy is as bad as adults as committing murder. So there is a difference there. But that said, we can never discount what we might consider lesser sins. You know, it's unfortunate that we live in a society where there are so many sins that are promoted and celebrated. It's terrible that we live in that. But as we live through that, we have to be mindful of what we also find in our own lives. And why I think Sodom is a good example of this is because normally when we consider the sin in Sodom, our first thought goes to the men who gathered at the door of Lot's house demanding that he turn over the Lord's men so that they could rape them. And that certainly depicts the level of depravity of Sodom. But when we find that God recounts the sin of Sodom in Ezekiel chapter 16, let's go ahead and turn over there, read a couple verses from there. Ezekiel chapter 16, that's not the first thing he points out. Ezekiel chapter 16, verses 49 and 50 read, "Look, this was the iniquity of your sister Sodom. She and her daughter had pride, fullness of food, and abundance of idleness. Neither did she strengthen the hand of the poor and the needy, and they were haughty and committed abomination before me. Therefore, I took them away as I saw fit." This is quite the verse to reflect on in our times. Pride, fullness of food, abundance of idleness, not strengthening the hand of the poor or the needy. Those are the things that God brings up first when he talks about the city of Sodom. And verse 50 does seem to be depicting the behavior found in Genesis 19, but the sin started deeper than that. I guess the point that I'm trying to make is it's easy to reflect on and get caught up in the atrocities committed in our society, but we can't lose sight of these sins. These are sins as well and continue to be seen as God as abominations. If we lose sight of those things and become accustomed to them, where will that lead us? Where will that lead us? We have to remember that sin is an active thing. It's an active force. And I find it interesting how many times in scriptures we find that sin is personified and portrayed as an active force. When God spoke with Cain after Cain had offered an unacceptable sacrifice to him, God told him that sin lies at your door and its desire is for you. Depicts sin as having a desire for Cain. And Paul also uses language like this. In Romans chapter 6, verse 12, Paul talks about sin reigning or ruling in our body. It's taking action. It's taking control. Romans 7 and 8 says that sin took opportunity through the law. So we find a lot of instances there where sin is it's portrayed as an active force. And if sin is an active force, then it requires us to have an active counterforce against it. Right, we see that if we go over to Hebrews chapter 3, and this is the other time, Dan, that I was warning you about. Hebrews chapter 3. I think I have like a minute left here. So try to make this point quick. Hebrews chapter 3, verses 12 and 15. "Beware, brethren, lest there be any of you an evil heart of unbelief in departing from the living God. But exhort one another daily what is called today, lest any of you be hardened through the deceitfulness of sin." So the warning there from the writer is that the deceitfulness of sin and how it will deceive us has to be counteracted with us being with one another and exhorting one another and reminding one another to stay faithful, to remain steadfast. All right, I think we're about out of time here. So just in closing, just bring up a couple here points. I hope this has been a good reminder of how God views sin and a reminder of how we ourselves should view sin. You know, we have much to be thankful for because as ugly as God sees sin, he put a plan in motion from the very beginning to deliver us from it. And he's gone great lengths to provide us with hope. So I just want to close here. Let's turn over to Romans chapter 5. I just want to close here by reading a few verses from Romans 5 as the kids are coming up here. verses 6 through 11. For when we were without strength, in due time Christ died for the ungodly. For scarcely for a righteous man will one die, yet perhaps for a good man someone would even dare to die. But God demonstrates his own love toward us, in that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. Much more then, having now been justified in his blood, we shall be saved from wrath through him. For if when we were enemies, we were reconciled to God through the death of his Son, much more, having been reconciled, we shall be saved by his life. And not only that, but we also rejoice in God through our Lord Jesus Christ, through whom we now received the reconciliation. So despite how God sees sin, he loves us enough that he gave his Son for us, so that it might be washed away.